Let's go to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9. Jesus is talking about true greatness. It's found in Mark 9, 33 through 37. And we have it coming to us in two ways. First of all, you have true greatness taught. And that's done in a very simple, short statement in verse 35. That will be followed with true greatness illustrated, which will be in verses 36 and following. Incidentally, I did forget to announce, and I do want to emphasize or reemphasize, that next Sunday evening will be the film called The Gods of the New Age. It's an hour and 45-minute film, will be in two parts, and I think you'll find it well worth seeing, and I think you'll be surprised at some of the things you see, how the consistency of the thread of Hinduism comes through in so much of our culture today, and I think you'll find it very, very worthwhile. In fact, the film is worthwhile enough that since the videotape is $15 rental, I think since some of you cannot be here next Sunday night, we'll probably just wait about a month and we'll run another showing of it at a non-service time for you that couldn't catch it. Alan? There'll be a break. There will be a break. No. No, it'll be one evening, hour 45 minutes next Sunday evening. Right, Bruce? I don't think so. Jane, do you know? I don't think so. The Wickham films, yes, we could, but I don't think you can on this. Interesting thing, I think I did tell you something about it. Basically, the film, at least the film distributor out east was saying that churches simply will not rent the film. It's too explosive to... too hot to handle is the remark, and they've had to cut the price of the film almost in half. But fortunately, we can have more of these now because, for example, this film in 16 millimeter was what, $99 for a rental, and the videotape is $15. So I think we're looking at a lot of things. Videotapes are really a coming thing. Probably not many people sitting here that doesn't have a VCR. So, but I don't think this is available for sale. It's a very dramatic film, very dramatic. You see some of the things that are involved with the Hinduism. It deals with the danger of divorcing your body and mind, how terribly dangerous this can be. Dave Hunt is in part of the film, but there are many, many experts. And I think you'll find the film very, very good. And may we add with something like that, just because we have a film of any sort doesn't mean we endorse everything in it. But I somehow think that Christians ought to be able to listen and look at something with discretion. And what is good, we want to use. And if you see something in there that isn't exactly have the T crossed doctrinally like you like to see it, disregard it. Okay, we're looking at true greatness taught, chapter 9, verse 35, in the following words. And sitting down, he called the 12 and said to them, if anyone wants to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all. And the emphasis that comes across, first of all, in this verse is on the word all. The word all is emphatic. And thus, if we were to read it exactly the way the Greek New Testament has it, it would read this way. If anyone wants to be first, of all, he shall be last, and of all, he shall be servant. So the idea is emphasizing the word all and the submission and the service that is involved in that. The second observation we ought to make off of this is that this is a reversal of human opinion in two ways. This is a complete reversal of human opinion in two ways. First of all, it is a complete reversal of human opinion in terms of what first and last mean. Reversal of human opinion in what first and last mean. To man, to be first is to be Lord. To be first is to be Lord. To God, or Jesus here, to be first is to be servant. And that is a complete reversal between the two. You also have the concept that to God, in verse 35, the way up is down. But up is down. This is one of those up is down verses. If you want to be first, the way to first is down, or servanthood. We also noted that this is a practical application of Mark 12:31 that says we're to love our neighbor as ourself. It's also a reaffirmation of self-denial that is called for in Mark 8:34. Now, let's put down some of the principles. Or, well, coming next, we have an illustration. True greatness illustrated. And that is when Jesus calls in the child in verse 36. True greatness illustrated. Verse 36. And taking a child, he stood him in the midst of them, and taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever receives one child like this in my name." Now that is important. In my name is carrying the idea across, or the principle across, which is simply this. The emissary of a man is the man himself. That was true in biblical culture. The emissary of the man is the man himself. So that there was no such thing as rejecting the representative of a man. If he is his representative and you reject the representative, you reject him. And notice how Jesus develops that in verse 37. Whoever receives one child like this in my name is receiving me. And whoever receives me is not receiving me, but him who sent me. So he is simply saying there is a chain. And the chain link is between my messenger, myself, and my Father. And he's simply saying that the response to the messenger goes all the way back to my Father. So that if you will not accept my messenger, then you do not accept me. If you do not accept me, you do not accept my Father. And takes it all the way back to the beginning. That, incidentally, is what gives dignity to service and being a servant. Is because we don't serve Christ's children. We cannot serve Christ's children without serving Him. And thus, whatever a believer does relative to serving another believer is treated by God as treatment of himself. Now, three principles come off of this passage on true servanthood. First of all, true servanthood. I'll just put true S to be brief. True servanthood is concerned only with the honor of Christ. True servanthood is concerned only with the honor of Christ. And that's what we have in Mark 9, verses 38 through 40. Verse 38. John said to him, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to hinder him because he was not following us." Notice what their concern was their own honor and their own reputation. But Jesus said, "Do not hinder him, for there is no one who shall perform miracle in my name and be able soon to speak evil of me, for he who is not against us is for us." And so his remark then is, you are concerned about who is following you. True servanthood is concerned with the honor of Christ. Second, true servanthood is based on others' relationship to Christ. And that comes in verse 41, which reads, "Whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because of your name as followers of Christ, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward." So the cup of water is offered because they belong to the Lord. Third principle, and that is true servanthood never destroys. True service never destroys. And that is the message that you have in the next verse, verse 42. "Whoever causes one of these little ones..." Now that can be taken two ways. You can take little ones in the sense of a believer, or you can take it literally in the sense of a child. He has set the child in the midst, and I see no reason not to take it that way. whoever causes one of these little ones, these little children, who believe to stumble. To stumble does not get it. The word for to stumble in Greek, stumble, doesn't get it for one reason. When you stumble, there's always the possibility of doing what? Whenever you stumble, you can always get up. That is not the meaning of this word. This word is used in context where the fall is fatal. Used repeatedly, a fatal fall. So, the word implies very clearly, it implies complete spiritual destruction. And thus, the idea, and we would paraphrase that for the meaning in that verse, it would read then in verse 42, whoever causes one of these little ones who believe to fall fatally, to be spiritually destroyed, it would be better for him if with a heavy millstone hung about his neck, he had been cast into the sea. Now, with this next section, the Lord begins to teach some of the demands of discipleship. What are the demands of discipleship? It's the rest of the chapter, verses 43 through 50. Now, again, reviewing what we've had before, remember in this last part of the book of Mark, two themes emerge. We've had it before. We're going to have it again in this section. The first, the two themes emerge in the last part, and they begin in Mark 8:29. And let's go back to that and then show how these two themes develop and kind of put this last part of Mark together. Mark 8:29 is where they begin. Mark 8:29 is a very climactic part of the book because up until this point of time, nobody has said even one word about Jesus being the Messiah. The only mention of Jesus as Messiah so far in the book of Mark, that's up to chapter 8 now, was in verse 1 where it says, this is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, or Jesus the Messiah. After that, you have miracles that show he is the Messiah, but nobody says it. You have healings that offer credentials that he is the Messiah, but nobody says it. There is no mention until we come to the climactic verse of chapter 8 and verse 29, where Peter finally says it. And in verse 29 of chapter 8, we have the following. He continued by questioning them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered and said to him, thou art the Messiah. So we begin in 8:29, where Peter says, thou art the Christ. Word Christ is the word for Messiah. Thou art the Christ. Now, that triggers two things. One, it triggers the theme of what does it mean for Jesus to be the Messiah? What does it mean for Jesus to be the Messiah? And that thread of teaching follows the rest of the book. What does it mean? What does it mean for Jesus to be Messiah? And that is a major, major idea that follows throughout the rest of the book. Now, at this point, if you would say to the disciples, what does it mean? Now you've said he's the Messiah. What does that mean to you? Their answer would be this. It means that Jesus is now going to reign in splendor and glory. That was the answer. That's what they'd been taught. That was locked into their minds, and that was their answer. Jesus is the Messiah. What does that mean? It means glory and splendor. So they associated with it reigning. They associated with it glory and splendor. And thus, when Peter says he is the Messiah, that was what is in their minds. That is correct, except it misses something very major. And that is what Jesus is going to say. What does it mean for me to be the Messiah? It means reigning and glory and splendor, but it means suffering first. It means I must die. That's what it means to be the Messiah. And in these closing chapters, he is continually teaching the disciples this fact. They begin by fighting it with all of their might. They say, we cannot buy that. We do not believe it. It's not true. And if you notice, coming down to chapter 8 and verse 31, and this had to be a shock to Peter. He's just said, you are the Christ. And he comes down to verse 31. He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he was stating the matter plainly. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. And then the Lord again turned, rebuked him. But their concept of what the Messiah was totally, totally confused in their minds. And he is going to have to say, the road to glory is through the cross. The cross, then the crown, is his teaching. The second thing that was triggered by the confession, thou art the Christ, is what is required of those that would follow him. What it means to be the Messiah. And second, what is required of his followers? Now, look at Mark 8, and you'll see how that all comes across very neatly. Then we'll take it to Mark 9. In Mark 8, 29, you are the Messiah. Next, what does it mean to be the Messiah? Verse 31, it means I must suffer and die. Next, what are the requirements of those that would follow him and be his disciples? Verse 34. He summoned the multitude with his disciples, said to them, if anyone wishes to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life shall lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel shall save it. So notice the way what we've put down here follows in the context. He is the Messiah. What does it mean to be Messiah? Mark 8, 31, it means I must die. And if you're going to follow me, here is what is required of all of my followers. Now let's go over to Mark 9. And in Mark 9, we will have the same sequence again. And so the sequence ought to be, he is the Messiah. What does that mean? And the answer ought to be the same as in chapter 8. It means I have to die. And then next we ought to expect what is required of those that will follow him. And notice that does hold true. 9:31. For he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered up into the hands of men, and they will kill him, and when he has been killed, he shall rise again 3 days later. What does it mean to be the Messiah? It means I must be killed, I must die. Verse 31. Then you would expect to follow, like in Mark 8, a little section on what is required of his followers. And notice when you come down to Mark 9:43, you've got that section that we're ready now to look at. Verse 43, if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life crippled than having your two hands to go into hell with unquenchable fire. Now, a few observations about what is involved in these demands. First of all, let's look at the character of the demands that Jesus is going to make. What is the character of these demands? Two things about them. Number one, they are radical. The demands are radical, and I know of no other way to express it than to say his demands are radical, and they're repeated over and over. Verse 43, if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. And I don't need to dwell on the fact that that's a pretty radical remedy. And in verse 45, if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. And verse 47, if your eye causes you to stumble, cast it out. Cut it off, cast it out. Those are very radical words. Now, first, we're back again. They are to be cut off if they cause you to stumble. And we have the same word we had previously for stumble, and it is the idea of spiritual destruction. If it is leading you to spiritual destruction, then do something radical about it. It's obvious that the stumbling in the context is spiritual. Look down at verse 47. Verse 47 says, if your eye causes you to stumble, cast it out. It is better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than having two eyes be cast into hell. And so the emphasis then is, if there's anything that is causing your spiritual destruction, deal with it. And the word for dealing with it is deal with it in a radical way. Second, focus on verse 43 and verse 45 on the word life. In verse 43, he says, if your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life. And then in verse 45, if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life. And I think it is a fair paraphrase to say that he means enter into life with or in fellowship with God. It is better, and you can see that meaning come out if we would read it that way in verse 43. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life in fellowship with the Lord, crippled. And then verse 45, if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life in fellowship with the Lord, lame, than having two feet to be cast into hell. It is radical. Anything that threatens spiritual destruction, we should deal with radically. Now, the second thing about these demands that Jesus makes is not only are they radical, but they are hyperbolic. They are radical. They are hyperbolic. A hyperbole is overstating something to make a point. We use hyperboles all the time. I'm starved to death. And that's, I've said it, you've said it, we'll continue to say it, but not really. I could eat an elephant. And it's a hyperbole, and hyperboles get across points fairly well. Now, in this section, I think we can fairly say that since these are hyperboles, that these verses are not teaching self-mutilation. There have been periods in church history when this passage was approached by some who meant very well and who were very seriously, who cut off hands, who cut off feet, and who cut off eyes, not taking this as hyperbolic, but as taking it to be teaching self-mutilation. Now, let's suppose, I'll make a couple of observations about it. Let's suppose he meant literally cut your hand off. Let's suppose that's what he meant. Literally, cut your hand off. Well, let me make some observations. He talks about the hand. He talks about the foot and the eye. And the observation is this. The hand, foot, and eye are not the root cause of sin. The hand, the foot, and the eye are not the root cause of sin. They are the instruments whereby sin is carried out. They are not the root cause of sin. They are its instruments. The actions, if the hand does something wrong, was that because your hand had a mind of its own? Or if your foot does the wrong thing, is that because your foot has a mind of its own? Or your eye, is there something behind the action of your hand? Your volition is behind it, isn't it? And your choices are behind it. Which means, let's suppose someone has a predilection toward having sticky fingers, and they steal, and you cut off both hands. You've solved the problem of stealing? Do you think if the problem were still there, they might devise a different way to pick things up? So obviously, dealing with each of these things, the act of sin would not be, or the root of sin would not be dealt with by dealing with the instruments. This is not teaching self-mutilation. It is saying this, whatever tempts us to disloyalty, whatever it is, must be dealt with radically. This is a hard passage because we do not like to deal with ourselves radically. Every week I go on a diet, but it's the problem with it. It's not radical enough. It doesn't do enough to really get the 3 or 4 pounds that I need to lose off. And consequently, Jesus is saying, if you have that which is going to cause your spiritual destruction, get radical about it. And how would you express a radical action? Could you do any better? If your hand is gets you in trouble, cut the thing off. If your feet get you in trouble, cut your feet off or cut your foot off. And deal with it radically is the point. All right, that has to do then with the character of the demands. Now let's look at the fact that the demands have an assumption. The character of the demands, and now the assumption of the demands. The assumptions are dual. The passage assumes the relative value of physical well-being. It assumes the relative value of physical well-being. By relative value, I simply mean that the passage assumes that there is something that is more important than physical well-being. And that is coupled with the other side of the assumption, which is the absolute value of spiritual well-being. It assumes the relative value of physical well-being and assumes the absolute value of spiritual well-being. And that's where the passage comes from. That's why he can say and make such radical demands. It is far better to have spiritual health than it is to have physical health. That is of great importance, and that is assumed by the passage. Now, let's come down to some concluding warnings that follow through in verses 49 and 50. Verses 49 and 50 are difficult. And I'll give you what it seems to me the passage is saying. This is a difficult section right here. Verse 49, everyone will be salted with fire. I think what he's talking about in verse 41 is the suffering that those who follow the Lord are going to have in this life. You are going to be salted with fire. For fire to be the believer's trial is not unusual. It's in the book of 1 Peter, talks about the fiery trial that is to try you. The association of salt with fire, and salt, what's the association of salt with sacrifice? If there's to be sacrifice for Christ, why is salt an appropriate metaphor? You want to know? Let's discover it. Leviticus chapter 2. Salt and sacrifice hold hands. And anyone acquainted at all with the sacrificial system of the Old Testament knows the principle of chapter 2 and verse 13 of Leviticus. Chapter 2:13 says, every grain offering of yours, moreover, you shall season with salt, so that the salt of the covenant of your God shall not be lacking from your grain offering. With all your offerings you shall offer salt. Salt and sacrifice always went together in the Old Testament. And I take it then that would fit very well with Mark chapter 9. You are going to be salted with fire as you live a sacrificial life for Christ on earth. Then, closing the chapter in verse 50, he points out that you ought to be very careful to maintain your savor. Salt is good, but if salt becomes unsalty, with what will you make it salty again? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another. Salt was that which gave a thing a unique flavor, and that is what the believer is to be. All right, coming out of this section now that we've covered, let's make some observations, and then we'll get just a little start into chapter 10. Observations. Number one. And for this, we're coming over to where we started this morning at chapter 9 and verse 31, where Jesus is teaching his disciples and telling them the Son of Man is to be delivered up into the hands of those that are going to kill him. And at this point, they draw a complete blank. They do not understand it. They resist it. However, Jesus keeps on teaching it. So note this note in the teaching of Jesus. The teaching of Jesus always recognizes the progressive nature of learning. The teaching of Jesus recognizes the progressive nature of learning. By that, it simply means that he repeats, he realizes that I taught you and you did not understand, but I recognize that. That leading, that teaching is progressive as far as its nature is concerned. For example, this principle working out. Jesus taught the disciples for a long time, almost 3 years. And in those 3 years, in his teaching, he made no mention of his death. Then one day, he made mention of his death, chapter 8 and verse 31, and they didn't understand it. So he repeated it, and then, as that teaching was placed in their minds, one day they suddenly realized what his suffering meant, and when was that? After the resurrection. So the Lord takes them very, very slowly into learning. Second, every prediction of his death is accompanied with a prediction of his resurrection. No exceptions to that. Death predictions were always, no exception, were always followed by resurrection prediction. All his death predictions were always followed by resurrection predictions. Third, and we had this morning, remember when it talked about how he was going to be delivered over to the hands of men, and we asked the question, who did it? Well, we have in Romans 8:32 that God the Father did it. We have in Galatians 2:20 that God the Son delivered himself, and we have the words that Judas delivered him over. So who delivered the Lord into the hands of men? Judas did, Jesus did himself, and God the Father did. And all of that was intended to fulfill God's one plan. So the observation we want to make is this. The single sovereign plan of God is often carried out by multiple means. The single sovereign plan of God is often carried out by multiple means. The verse that you know states that so well. Paul says, and we know that all things work together for good. Single sovereign plan of God, good. To them who are the called according to his purpose. And the word good points to the sovereign plan, and the word all things points to all the multiple means that God uses to bring that about in the lives of his children. The interesting thing about seeing the means whereby he carries out his plan is you never see it in prospect, you always see it in retrospect. You can look back and see how it worked out, but at the time, we often cannot. Fourth observation, the ignorance of the disciples shows the solitary nature of Jesus' suffering. Solitary, I mean he did it all alone. It shows the solitary nature of his suffering. And it's against the background of their lack of sympathy that we see his determination to go to Jerusalem as these chapters are leading us and die for the sins of men. Fifth, spiritual greatness makes two demands. Spiritual greatness demands that we renounce, taking time to route these things because they're important principles, spiritual greatness demands that we renounce all human ideas of what greatness is and how to get there. What greatness is and how to get there. And that is what we started with tonight. If a man will be first, let him become last and become servant of all. And that is not exactly the program you would hear if you would go to a seminar on how to recognize your self-worth and your value. You would not be told those particular words. To be spiritually great, both the what and the how of greatness on the human level has to be renounced. Six. The demands of Jesus that we've had in these verses require us to make spiritual values of sole and supreme importance in life. Jesus demands that spiritual well-being be our sole priority. He does not say that physical well-being is wrong, and it does not say that physical well-being is not legitimate. He does say, don't you dare allow it to take the place of prime importance. Now, we've got time enough in the last 15 minutes to get started on a very interesting chapter, and that is chapter 10, verses 1 through 12, and it is centered about questions on divorce. Questions on divorce. Mark 10, verses 1 through 12. It's our next paragraph we want to look at. And a few things, just by way of introduction to this chapter. Number one, the teaching of Jesus in these 12 verses is prompted by questions. The teaching here is prompted and brought forth by questions. Now, saying that, there are times when Jesus teaches and he's not prompted by his audience at all. In other words, he initiates it. He says, here's what I'm going to teach you. And it's not responding to their needs. It's not responding to their questions. It's simply spontaneous teaching on his part. I think when we get to chapter 9, verse 31, that we've just looked at, you've got a beautiful example of teaching that Jesus initiated himself. Verse 31, he was teaching his disciples and telling them, the Son of Man is to be delivered up in the hands of men. And you know why he's teaching that? Because they asked him to teach them about that. Not quite. This was totally uninitiated type thing. Now, notice, in this chapter, the whole thing revolves about questions. In 10:2 and in 10:10. 10:2 reads, some Pharisees came up to him, testing him, and began to question him whether it was lawful for a man to divorce a wife. And he answers. But come then down to verse 10. And in verse 10, in the house, the disciples began questioning him about this again. So the whole body of teaching in all 12 verses is, first of all, a response to the Pharisees' question, and second, a response to the disciples' question. So the first point of introduction is this is prompted by questions. Second, the most Jews, probably the majority, the most Jews agreed on the legality of divorce. Most Jews agreed, this is just introduction, on the legality of divorce as far as the Mosaic law was concerned. They had no problems, and they did not debate. You did not have Jewish groups that said no divorce. the two major Jewish groups both were together on the fact that divorce is legal, and that was based on Deuteronomy 24:1. Now, let's go back to that, and once we have said they agreed on the legality of divorce, they had a problem with one word in Deuteronomy 24 and verse 1. And the interpretation of this word divided the Jews into two classes. Deuteronomy 24, 1. When a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes, because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, and so forth. And on the basis of this verse, and rightly so, the Jews agreed that in the law, divorce is legal. They all agreed on that point. But there is one word in verse 24, the interpretation of which they broke into two separate schools. Can you guess what it is? What is the basis for the divorce in chapter 24, verse 1? It's because he has found some indecency in her. So the disagreement or the problem is, what does the word indecency mean? What does or what is included in the word indecency? And at that point, the Jews broke into two schools under rabbis. The first one was the school of Shammai, S-H-A-M-I. And Shammai said that the word indecency means something morally, shameful, was the way they stated it. Something indecency means something morally, emphasis on morally, morally shameful, i.e., adultery. And that was the school of Shammai, which basically, again, they would all agree, Deuteronomy makes divorce legal. The word indecency refers to something morally shameful, as over against physically wrong, or emotionally wrong, something morally shameful, i.e., or namely, adultery. Now, there was another school, the school of Hillel, H-I-L-L-E-L, and they agreed that it referred to something shameful. However, they took the word indecent to mean anything that annoyed or embarrassed a husband. So, literally, the word indecency could mean anything. Anything that annoyed the husband. Now, those two schools are quite a way apart. Let me give you two examples of actual cases under rabbis. One, for example, Rabbi Hillel allowed as a charge for divorce and granted divorce that in cooking she burned his food. And Hillel granted that that is a valid charge. She burned your toast. If you want to divorce her, say so, give her a bill of divorcement, and that is adequate, and that is covered by Deuteronomy 24:1. Rabbi Akiba is a cooler fellow yet. Rabbi Akiba allowed a man to divorce his wife because he found a better looking woman. Now that's a rather liberal view of divorce. And that's what we had, basically, in the first century, this type of thing. Now, what is happening in Mark chapter 10 is the Pharisees were laying Hillel's teaching in front of Jesus and saying, what do you think? So, again, an introduction. The Pharisees, in this context, laid Hillel's teaching, namely that you can be divorced for anything, in front of Jesus for evaluation. What do you think of it? Make a comment on it. Now that becomes even clearer if we will look at Matthew chapter 19. That it was the Hillel school that they wanted Jesus to comment on. Matthew 19. And verse 3. This is the same event. And very clearly in verse 3, they're putting this Hillel doctrine that you can divorce your wife for any reason, burning your food, clear up to finding a better looking woman. And in verse 3, it says, some Pharisees came to him, testing him and saying, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause at all? In other words, they're not saying, is there any reason? The meaning of it, is it lawful for him to divorce his wife for any cause that he happens to dream up, like Hillel teaches us? And that is the setting that is involved in this particular context. Let me read to you from Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews, and I'm quoting from him to show how popular the Hillel view was. Quote, he that desires to be divorced from his wife for any cause whatsoever, and many such causes happen among men, let him in writing give assurance that he will never use her again as his wife anymore, for by these means she may be at liberty to marry another husband, although before this bill of divorce be given, she is not permitted to do so. So notice, he espouses that very, very broad view. Now, going back to Mark 10, notice one other thing that we ought to add in getting into the passage, and that is this. The question that they asked was intended as a trap. It was not a question for information. The question was meant to be a trap. They weren't interested in what Jesus thought on divorce. They didn't care what he thought on divorce. All they wanted was to get him in a trap. And notice when you read Mark 10, verse 3, Mark notes that, and some Pharisees coming up to him, testing him. This is a trap. And I think we have time to point out that it was a very clever trap that had a four-way sting to it. Number one, or let's put, how could his answer ensnare? And that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to ensnare him. How could the answer of Jesus possibly ensnare him? Four ways. Number one, let's suppose that he sided with Hillel. Out of that could come the charge, moral laxity. If he went with that school. If, on the other hand, he went with Shammai, that allowed it only for adultery, then when the wife pulls off some other things that are equally bad, why do you advocate being so tolerant with sinners? So with Shammai, they would point to moral tolerance. You know, you let her get by with anything, don't you? If, and I think this is the one that they probably expected, if Jesus went along with neither of those schools, but let's suppose he came off and said no divorce. Now, how's that a trap? You've now ensnared him with the law, Deuteronomy 24:1. So if Jesus teaches no divorce, he contradicts Moses. He contradicts Moses' teaching in Deuteronomy 24:1. So what way is he going to go? Can you see how this is a neat trap? Well, not a neat trap, it's an evil trap. But they are sure this number will do him in for good. Because any way he goes, we're going to trap him. But there was one other trap here that we may not see. The subject of divorce had been discussed by the forerunner of Jesus and had gotten him thrown in jail. Go back to Mark 6. Our fourth observation is the subject of divorce landed John in jail. Not under the Jewish system, but under the Romans. And wouldn't it be nice if we could get the Romans to act against him so we wouldn't? Remember chapter 6, going down to verse 17? For Herod, that's the civil authority, Herod Antipas, himself had sent and had John arrested and bound in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, because he had married her, and John had been saying to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. So into jail he goes. Now, it's interesting that Herod Antipas was the procurator over Perea. And guess where Jesus is in Mark chapter 10? He's in Perea. He's in his jurisdiction. So doubtless they thought, well, we've got him four ways. Maybe we can have him say something that will inflame Herod, and Herod will do with him what he did with John. That would be neat. He would be taken care of. So notice then, the whole thing was constructed to bring about conflict with Shammai, or if he goes another way, with Hillel, or if he goes another, with the law, Deuteronomy 24, if he goes another with Herod. They asked this question, tempting him. And there's the trap, right there. And you would look at that and say, any way the Lord goes, they're going to nail him. And I'm sure they were very confident that whatever direction he did, they would be able to nail him on this particular account. And they were ready very much to do just that. You see, a couple of the strange bedfellows in the New Testament are the association of the Pharisees and the Herodians. Generally, the Jews hated the Herodians because the Herodians represented the Roman government. And the Roman government had them in captivity, and therefore they hated them. Except they were able to get together with the Herodian political party, who they hated, because they found something in common that made them fast friends. They both felt the same way about Jesus. We can't stand him. Look, for example, chapter 3, verse 6 in Mark. Chapter 3, verse 6 reads, the Pharisees went out immediately, began taking counsel with the Herodians against him as to how they might destroy him. And you have that reiterated, and we'll look at it in closing, in chapter 12 of Mark. Chapter 12, verse 13. This little plot to get Jesus caught in a statement that was unwise had been a joint effort of Pharisees and Herodians. So verse 13 of chapter 12 says, they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to him in order to trap him in a statement. And that's where we begin in Mark chapter 10 the teaching of this little section here on divorce. It's intended to be a trap for Jesus. One closing thing. Notice how the Pharisees ask a question, and Jesus asks a question, and the Pharisees avoid it. Verse 2, some Pharisees came up to him, testing him, began to question him whether it was lawful for a man to divorce a wife. And he answered and said to them, what did Moses command you? And their answer is evasive. Their answer in verse 4 is, and they said, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. And Jesus is going to say, if you want to know what Moses commanded concerning marriage and divorce, don't go to Deuteronomy 24. Go to Genesis 2, verse 24, and he will take them back to that point, and we will find the exposition of it. But we will pick up with that point in verses 2 through 9 next class. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word and its power. We pray that we will come to know the Lord Jesus Christ so that we might be like him. In his name we pray. Amen.